Being a chef means keeping your cool in the kitchen. It's up, it's up. And with Resi Priority Notify and Global Dining Access through my Amex Platinum card,
right this way,
it's nice to try someone else's food for a change. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
This crowd rises to its feet. Totoro slammed it home. Garland left wing. Three ball. Perfect. Garland went to the lane. Locked the Mobley. Pow. And Allen blocked the shot at the rim. Pow with the left hand and a foul.
Welcome to the Chase Down Podcast, part of the Chaos Media family. I'm your host, Justin Rowan. The Chase Down is presented by Fubo TV. Watch over 100 channels of live sports and TV for half the cost of cable. There's no contract and no commitment. Try for free at FuboTV.com. As promised, no Carter Rodriguez this week. We're giving you listeners a little bit of a break, but to replace him, I brought in the big guns. From Bleacher Report, host of one of my favorite national podcasts, Hardwood Knox, Dan Favalli, making his long-awaited debut on the Chase Down, I believe. Dan, how you doing?
I am excited, stoked to be here, ready to tank your downloads. And it was, look, I owed you, been on Hardwood Knox, like it probably like double digit times at this point, 10. So I owed you more than one, that's for sure.
I honestly, this is 100% on me that I haven't had you on. I don't have an excuse. I don't even have a rationale. There's just no excusing it. I apologize profusely. And if you can hear me, I'm sorry. But, any listeners of the Levitard show probably get that reference. You know what? Honestly, going into last night's game, because we're recording this on Thursday night, I kind of was expecting the worst because the Cavs have been inconsistent lately. They have really struggled on the road, and they came away with one of their best road wins in a very long time. Obviously, the win in Boston without Darius Garland stands out as probably the best road win that they've had this season. But given their struggles, getting the monkey off their back and getting a signature win, blowing out the Dallas Mavericks, who have been a lot better at home, very similar to the Cavs, was a really, really impressive win. Dan, what stood out to you looking at that game and the Cavs finally getting back on track with the signature road win?
I'll have you know, I went back and watched stuff from that game just specifically for this podcast because I've had an overexposure to the Mavericks this season, and that was just a game that I was like, I needed to pass on.
That's dedication. Thank you.
Right. But yeah, so I think what's huge is you have Donovan Mitchell, obviously. It felt like their half-court offense was just more coherent, and that's really, they've had one of the best half-court offense in the league this year, and on the road, it's just like imploded over the past month or so. Mm. And a lot of it seems like decision-making, a lot of it seems like guys missing shots that they normally wouldn't. But Donovan Mitchell being huge, and then Lamar Stevens just absolutely going back and watching some of the stuff that he did, was a monster on defense for them. I thought they did a really good job of just pressuring Luka on the defensive end overall. And if you make life difficult on him, you make your whole life a lot easier. And then I think, I can't remember, as the Cavs made the run in, or not the Cavs, the Mavs made the run in like the third quarter or whatever it was, being able to withstand that and not just sort of like wilting and blowing another lead down the stretch, because clutch time has not been kind to them on the road over the past month either. No. And so I think kind of avoiding that situation altogether probably helped them. But Lamar Stevens specifically, I think, was that stands out as something like, oh, if he's going to be able to, no, not do that on a nightly basis, but if you're going to be able to get that type of defensive effort and then offensive just scalability from him, it's going to make you at least miss Dean Wade a lot less for now.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was probably the best game Lamar has had this season. Really impressed with him on the defensive end. And this is the second time he's done this in kind of a marquee matchup. The Cavs put him on Giannis the first time they played in Milwaukee, and he did a great job in that game. And I was just really impressed with his off-ball movement, because I kind of feel like over this recent stretch, with Kevin Love out, Dean Wade out, Donovan Mitchell out, obviously you're missing a lot of spacing, and I think that might be one of the causes of the offense getting a little stagnant. But Lamar was moving off ball a lot better. Like, Dallas was completely ignoring him the same way that they, most teams have been ignoring both he and Okoro, and Lamar made them pay for that. He was cutting baseline, getting the possessions in the dunker spot and making them pay. But you're right. I honestly think this really comes down to Donovan Mitchell, because Chris Fedor had reported this after the Spurs loss, how Mitchell, when he found out that the Cavs still had a timeout after he got that offensive rebound under the basket, was just really beating himself up and was kind of beside himself, apologizing profusely. And this is another one of those games where whether it's the showcase game against the Lakers or some of these other marquee matchups that the Cavs have had this season, where Mitchell just kind of shows the value of experience, just the fact that he's been there before and him being such a big time performer. And I really thought he set the tone early on, and everyone else just kind of fell in line from there. I'm so impressed by him, and I continue to be insanely wrong about Mitchell. Like, I was excited after the trade, but my perception of him coming into this season, I think I was entirely too low on him.
It's funny how I think perceptions of players can change if they're on teams that grow stale or viewed as underachieving. I think that kind of butchered how people viewed him. I think, look, you go back and watch this game, and I know the Mavs look different now, but the way that Dallas was trying to actively attack and roast Mitchell in the playoffs last year without Luka Doncic, like, it was Jalen Brunson trying to carve him up, and the extent to which it was working juxtaposed against what you watched on Wednesday night is just like, that's like, yeah, his offense has been incredible. We knew he was an incredible offensive player. Did we think that he was going to be the best high volume off the dribble 3-point shooter in the league this season? I probably wouldn't have predicted it being right up there with Steph Curry, but the defensive effort from him and just how much, even if you don't want to go as far as saying like he's been useful, because I still think that the Cavs could use more point of attack options defensively. He's just not been like this monstrous liability relative to what we've watched in Utah really over the past two seasons. So that was almost just and that's not even just the Dallas game. Like, that's just stood out constantly whenever I'm watching the Cavs this season.
Yeah. And honestly, it's one of those things, like, I've been doing this for a while, podcasting, blogging about the NBA, and like, the more kind of experience I get, the more NBA seasons I see, like, the less confident I feel like talking about players and stuff like that. Like, I kind of have more of an understanding and of appreciation of just how little we can tell from the outside, because when I'm looking at Utah getting stale towards the end there, it's okay. If this guy wasn't happy on one of the best teams in the Western Conference and has talked about his desire to play for the Knicks, who weren't in the playoffs last season, like, is he about winning? Is he about the right things? And it's so clear that he is, right? Like, the fit in Cleveland has been so seamless. He's been willing to be a part of the team instead of like, this is just completely my show. Like, obviously he's got that alpha dog mentality where he'll step up in these moments and really kind of help them in these games where they can really use that kind of a performance. But he's been a part of a collective, and it just goes to show, like, there's so little that we can really ascertain from the outside. And I continue to be incredibly wrong about him. And I really think it's valuable. Like, we've talked about in the past, like, what Ricky Rubio brought to the table, both helping Mitchell when he was in Utah, helping Garland last season. I think having someone like Mitchell around that knows how to elevate and prepare for these big games, like, obviously, it's pretty straightforward. You're having a marquee game. You want to step up and have a big game. But just being there to provide insight to Darius Garland, Evan Mobley, Jared Allen, of how to prepare for these games, how to really kind of put the work in that helps pay these dividends in these moments, I think that's really valuable, because experience is something that this team is still at a deficit with.
I also think that's definitely valuable, but from Mitchell's perspective, there's got to be value in, and I think if you know, and you were probably one of the people that did, but like, there's a tendency among fans and even some media members, like, they're not following it closely enough amongst the local media. And if you talk to them or read them, like, you kind of understood that Donovan Mitchell was not like this locker room cancer or necessarily all about him. But I also think, like, going into a different environment where you're forced to, even if you think you're or are the best player on the team, like, you're forced to adapt and adjust, and this isn't what you've known your entire career, I would have to think that gives him a different perspective, and it's going to make him more open to change, because you don't want to be the issue that stands out. And so it's like, you know, it's quid pro quo there, where that's what the Cavs are sort of doing for, and they're surrounding him with talent. Where, look, Darius Garland specifically, just, they never gave Donovan Mitchell in Utah a safety valve like him, to where Mitchell is like, when he's needed to play make this season, he's done a really good job, looking back to that stretch where Darius Garland was out for the most part. But like, Darius Garland streamlines Donovan Mitchell's responsibilities in ways that the Jazz, even when they had Mike Conley, never really could, maybe in part because it always seems like they were dealing with one or two injuries. But the Cavs allow Donovan Mitchell to do that. And so I think it's been a really good fit from that perspective. And it's like you said, as much as people got on Donovan Mitchell and as much people believe that the bubble was fake basketball or whatever. Like, he has just come up huge in big time games time and again. It's like, yeah, he's fallen apart before, but also the fact that he was in that position to be in those big games says a lot about how, one, how good he is. And then you've mentioned experience a bunch of times. I've grown as I feel like I know less about the NBA each and every year, almost like you, which is fairly problematic when you're tasked with covering it full time. You do develop this level of appreciation for experience and finding the known quantities where you can. And it's like, I knew Donovan Mitchell was this known offensive quantity. Did I think he was going to be maybe as scalable or plug and play as it feels like he's been in Cleveland? Maybe not, but you grow an appreciation for like, oh, this guy's been in the big games, and I'm not going to be someone who says, oh, the Pelicans aren't contenders because they haven't been there or done that before. But it definitely matters to me that the Cavs were able to acquire someone like Mitchell, who, one, so obviously filled their biggest void if you watch them towards the end of last season. Yeah. And two, it's just been in those huge games before. And so nothing, you know, making the finals, sure, but like beyond that, like, it's not going to be new to him. And so I have no doubt that that's probably huge behind the scenes, especially for a young core like the Cavs, where even last season, and, you know, Cavs fans in our Discord say this, like, the vibes are always immaculate. And it seems like these guys actually want to learn, enjoy being around each other. And so when you have that mindset versus this stale nature that was in Utah, where it felt like everybody was grading on everybody, and you're dealing with, you know, not different generations overstates it, but like guys who maybe weren't necessarily on the side. Like, Joe Ingles was a million years old before he was traded from Utah. Ditto for Mike Conley being there and coming in. So that, I wonder if that sort of helps with like that gap in timeline, or just gap in ideology, or just place you're at in your career, where it's not really as enormous, or if it's just a matter of like, you're not dealing with the ego clash of a Donovan Mitchell and Rudy Gobert. And it's, there's no, Darius Garland doesn't seem like a guy who has ego. He's also already been paid, so he's not playing for his next contract. He doesn't have people saying he's overrated like Gobert did. So it just feels like a confluence of circumstances that maybe I specifically didn't consider going in, that made this even more of a perfect match than, like, you and I did a podcast on it afterwards when you came up with the outlook. I was in love with the trade, and you, like you said, you weren't, you're higher on it now than you were before, but you were pretty like showering it with praise as well. So yeah, the fact that it's exceeded even what was pretty optimistic expectations is pretty wild.
Yeah. And I remember when we had Tony Jones on, like you said, talking to the local beat, right, and getting some of that behind the scenes, you get a better feeling for it. And just you have to imagine, right, like, he took ownership of some of those struggles too, right? Like, he talked about how he wasn't in good enough shape and how he wanted to commit himself to both ends of the floor. And sometimes when you have that change of scenery, you're rejuvenated, and it's not the fault of anybody there. It just kind of runs its course. Like, we see that time and time and again, that things can grow stale in the NBA, and being around a bunch of guys that are closer to his age too, right? Like, that's going to make a difference. And even though the Cavs don't have the wing playmaking that the Jazz did with Boyan and Ingles, you have more kind of dynamic big men, right? Like, Evan Mobley's passing in the short role was massive against Dallas. Like, a lot of those Lamar dunker spot feeds were because Mobley's processing speed, as he catches the ball, he automatically sees Lamar. He makes the right pass. The big passing that they have. Like, I really do feel like, as good as Mitchell has been, the key to the Cavs and their identity is when offense is running through the big men, because there are going to be limitations when you have shorter guards as your best players, right? Like, there's just things that the defense can do to Garland and Mitchell that you wouldn't be able to do to like a Jason Tatum or LeBron James or Kevin Durant. And to the Cavs' credit, and I think everybody watching the situation has pretty consistently said, the development of Evan Mobley is going to be key for that, because even though they don't have that playmaking forward at the wing, you have it at the power forward, or you have a raw version of it in Evan Mobley. How has Mobley's season kind of, what's your feeling with him so far this year?
I've been, I think, happy and impressed with the extent to which he's been able to branch out on offense within the context of having Darius Garland and Donovan Mitchell both there. And it's, I would still like to see moments where maybe things are being run for him, or he's more aggressive as a scorer. But you've already mentioned like the short roll passing and the way he's able to pass there in general, trusting him to decision make with the ball in his hands, even if it's not directly leading to an assist, but someone who's attacking, or if like the moves he's using. There was a stretch where he was like lights out too on hook shots this year. And so I think when you look at some of the numbers, like the metrics aren't catching up to how good he is. But I was just having this conversation with my co-host Grant Hughes, that he is very much, when you watch it, even the plays that don't come together, that is the it guy. And it's, you know, jump ahead, I don't know how many years, but it, I know that the best case scenario is he becomes the best player for this team, but it also sort of feels like when you watch him, the most likely scenario now is that a few years down the line, he is, in fact, if this core is still together, the best player for this team.
Wow, that's high praise. And it's funny, you mentioned the Cavs' struggles in clutch situations, right? This year, they haven't been able to close out games as well as they would have liked. The Dallas game isn't going to go in that category, but it's one of those games where it still feels like they closed well because Luka was catching fire in the fourth quarter. They cut it to 9 points. I believe the Cavs called a timeout at that point and then immediately went on a run to extend it to 15 and give themselves breathing room again. Sometimes the best clutch offense is preventing it from getting into that situation where all of a sudden it's a one or two possession game where you're really kind of feeling that pressure. You're on the road. You're against one of the most talented offensive players the league has ever seen in Luka Doncic. Like, that's certainly a situation, especially coming off that Spurs loss. And even the two recent home games as well, where you kind of made it a lot harder on yourselves than it needed to be. That's certainly a situation where you could see this team fold. So even though I think they showed resilience here, I don't think that necessarily means we're not going to see those issues pop up again this year, right? Like, when people talk about what separates the Cavs from that contender tier in the NBA, experience is one of the biggest things. And that's not just something that's going to pop up in the playoffs, right? Like, you're going to see that in the regular season. You're going to see kind of these spells where they just can't really figure things out and the offense gets a little gunky at times. But at this point, we also are kind of at like this 30-game mark in the NBA. And even though some people think that the NBA season doesn't start until football season is over, after 30 games, you usually get a pretty good feel for who the playoff teams are. And unless there's some dramatic shakeup, this is kind of who teams are. And I'm curious, as we kind of reach this third of the season point, do you feel like the Cavs have overachieved, underachieved, or are they kind of on schedule for where you expected them this year?
I think they're probably on schedule. I might have had them finishing third or fourth in the East, and so they're sort of right where I would expect them to be. I think when you look at the margins that are separating them from literally everybody else below them, it's very tiny, and so there could be some noise.
Ridiculously tight. I think that's why there's so much anxiety when the Cavs go through a funk, because even though you can say, oh, you're like 3-4 games out of first place, you're also 4 games out of ninth, right?
Yeah, I would say I've been pleasantly surprised where, one, like, I was just wondering how the defense was going to look when there was going to be churn at the three spot and you were going to play with the two small guards and Mitchell and Garland. Like, that has, it's the offense. We're talking about clutch struggles and their performance on the road. Like, it's been the offense that is concerning you more than the defense there. Even with the offense overall, I thought there might have been more of it, and I don't know if it helped or if it was just indifferent, the time that Mitchell had alone independent of Garland. Like, did that do anything to sort of assuage the transition? I don't know, but I've been pleasantly surprised for the most part how that has unfolded. I don't know if it's come together to a point where it's like, oh, the Cavs are like this juggernaut, where it still feels, you know, and Dean Wade's out right now. We haven't seen what Rubio does to the depth of this team. So it does still feel like they are one player away from being like, if you want to crack the Milwaukee Boston tier of title contention. But I also think, like, when we were talking about the Cavs as contenders, would we have said, oh, well, like, if you're going to mention Denver, Memphis, even New Orleans, like, the Cavs are on that tier too. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's where they expected to be. I mean, the Mitchell trade is traditionally one that you make when you give up that much thinking that, but it was also such a move that was so clearly geared towards their bigger picture to say that they are a second tier contender, even if that tier is just ultra crowded right now. It's probably akin to, you know, exceeding expectations at the moment. And the fact that they've gone through all these struggles since, like, with the losing streak start on November 7th or whatever it was back then, and they are still third in the East despite the margins, like, being so thin, that counts for something. Like, they're still there, and they've been there for quite a while now, I believe.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting because it has felt uneven, but when you look at the overall averages, it is still encouraging. Like, right now, they're 12th in offense, 2nd in defense, 2nd in net rating. The defense has traveled really well. They're 2nd in road defense. They're 2nd at home defense. They have the 3rd best road net rating in the NBA, which seems ridiculous.
That I did not know. And yeah, that seems wild. Yeah,
That's like hard to kind of wrap my head around. I actually hadn't looked that up until like a second ago. And obviously that is really helped by how good their defense has been on the road, because they're road offense drops from 12th at home to 15th on the road. So it's not as dramatic as of a difference as I would have expected before I really dove into the numbers. But I do think even comparing it to last year where the defense didn't travel well, where they were 4th in home defense and 12th in road defense, like the fact that they're playing consistent defense, I think that gives them a really steady floor. And I also think the fact that the defense has been so good everywhere, it probably leads to some of the frustrations, because if you go cold like this and you're almost any other team, you usually get blown out on the road. And there hasn't been a lot of those games. They've still hung around, even though guys are really struggling and underperforming. And it comes down to one or two possessions at the end. And those results just carry so much more kind of emotional weight than the typical off night where you just get killed by 20 points in Milwaukee.
Yeah, that's a good point, because like people are more tuned in because those possessions start to matter and they're more invested in them. And so you're taking more, you're paying more attention to what goes wrong. I was going to ask you, though, when you're looking at their road struggles, and they are 23rd in road offensive efficiency over the past since that the losing streak I mentioned it on November 7th, their shooting has been just so atrocious from deep during that stretch. And specifically, what is going on with Darius Garland's road splits? There, can you explain that to me? And I didn't have time to even like go back, watch every possession, what's up, but like it is demonstrably worse than what he's been doing in Cleveland.
Yeah, for people that are unaware, right now Darius Garland is averaging 26-8 at home, on a true shooting percentage of 64.4. On the road, he is averaging 16-7. With a 46% true shooting percentage. So that is night and day. And I think when you look at some of the road struggles, it's a situation where I feel like if you get even like a B minus game from Darius Garland, you probably come away with a win. And it's so strange to me because you look at last season and this wasn't the case. Like his road home performances, there wasn't much variance to it. Part of me kind of wonders, because the original kind of road struggle he had was that West Coast road trip they had at the start of the year. He was reportedly battling illness when he was on that trip, playing through that and struggled in some of those games. But looking at the splits further, I kind of wonder if he's just having a bad December. Because in November, he was averaging 24-9 pretty much on really high efficiency. In December, whether he's at home or on the road, he's struggling. Like he's averaging just shy of 17 points per game, 7 assists, and he just seems to be in a funk. And I don't know, it's hard to figure out the correlation and the causation here. Like, is part of that, does that have to do with the fact that Kevin Love just missed a bunch of time? Dean Wade has been out, so you're losing two spacers there. And then Donovan Mitchell just missed two games. Like, I don't know if that's part of it. It feels like he's also pressing a little bit more recently. The last couple games, I feel like rather than going to kind of his signature floater in the paint, he seems to be taking it to the rim and trying to draw contact. And while that contact is there, he's still not great at selling those calls and seems to get really frustrated with the officiating and the amount of contact that's being allowed at the rim without a whistle. So I don't know if it's a combination of pressing, if the decrease in spacing recently has had an impact on it. But I kind of expect the home and road splits to normalize. But I do think that this December stretch, these 7 games where he's kind of really struggled from the field overall, I think that's probably more to do with it rather than him just really feeling comfortable in Cleveland versus every other city in the NBA.
Yeah, the decline in shooting is a good point, too, where it's you're missing guys who space the floor. And even when, like, you know, Kevin Love going, what was it, 0-for-4 from the floor in the Dallas game.
He still has some gravity, right?
Right. So that has to help. But it, like, even just sort of like the decline of the Caris LeVert fit and his shooting splits hurting, like, I do wonder how much that might shrink the floor for him, or at least tighten up the spaces, or make him second guess what he's doing in general.
Yeah, I completely agree. But Dan, do you know one thing I never second guess? It's the support we get from Zoom. Support for this podcast and the following message comes from Zoom. 500,000 businesses connect using Zoom, a single platform for phone, chat, workspaces, events, apps, and video. Zoom enables real-time collaboration for teams around the globe. Zoom, how the world connects.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge.
or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
I do want to kind of get a sense for your feelings about the overall spacing, because it was tenuous to begin with, I think, going into this year. But I think they made a couple bets, because when you trade for Donovan Mitchell, obviously you are consolidating some of your depth. You lose the floor spacing. Lowry Markkanen and Colin Sexton was a good shooter. Ochai Agbaji projected to be a good shooter, although I still believe he hasn't hit a three yet in the NBA in Utah. But it really feels like the Cavs are still missing a decent amount of functional spacing. And I feel like a couple of the gambles that you made in that consolidation was, one, top end talent's the hardest thing to acquire in the NBA. So when you have that opportunity, you jump on it and figure out the rest later. But the other things was, I think Dean Wade kind of projected to be a bigger part than he has been. I think the fact that he hasn't has more to do with injuries than his own performance, which has been unfortunate. And then also Dylan Windler was having a great training camp, and I think they expected to get a little bit out of him after last season, him finally getting healthy, playing 50 games. And, maybe there was some hope that he would be able to fill out the spots. Do you feel like some of the Cavs' inconsistency has to do with their personnel, or do you think it just has more to do with the players being younger and still going through some of the growing pains?
I think I might still argue it's more of the latter, and maybe even throwing in just there's been a stop and start feel to their season, where it begins with the Garland injury. You said, you have Mitchell missing a couple games, but also just like, Dean Wade losing the option there, trying to figure out what's having to go on with the three spot. I do think the functional shooting, though, is a concern overall, and it's something that I throw back at you, because our tagline at Hardwood Knox is try and be the least sufferable national podcast out there. And so we try and really tune into like what the fans want to talk about when it comes to their local team, because we don't want to be regurgitating the same storylines. I thought this year was going to be spent ignoring the three spot or talking about how overrated it was. Fans seem genuinely concerned about what the Cavs should do there. And they've tied so much of their struggles to just it's not even uncertainty, but just like the talent they have available at the three spot is not the talent that's going to plug the holes we're talking about with Cleveland. And I do think it's such a hyper focus because, one, four of your spots in the crunch time unit are locked down. So that's just the only spot to really focus on in the rotation. And it doesn't seem like Caris LeVert is necessarily going to be the answer. I think it could be Dean Wade when we're talking about 3-point volume or functional shooting. And by that, I mean like really scoring a ton off movement or quick fire movement, maybe even creating for yourself a little bit. It does feel like the Cavs have a deficit there. I am wondering to you, though, and I haven't been able to figure it out because the Cavs are just so good already, whether that concern is overstated or if this is something acquiring a player who adds the functional shooting. I'm not talking a star. I'm just talking someone who injects some 3-point volume and accuracy into the half court offense specifically. Is that something that could really push Cleveland to the next level? Or again, like I said, is this concern sort of overstated when you're looking at where the genesis of some of these struggles are coming from and then just how good the Cavs have been anyway?
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily overstated, because I think it's just a function of them once again kind of overachieving, right? Like the fact that they're so good already kind of makes you want, from a roster construction standpoint, to remove any impediments that are kind of might slow the growth, right? Because I think if you had a consistent shooter out there that just kind of fits and doesn't really do a ton, but just alleviate some of the pressure that those four can have, because Mobley and Allen really don't have that outside game. Like, I think it just makes it easier to evaluate them. It makes the growth and development process a whole lot easier. And I agree. Like I think it would work with Dean Wade. I think on paper that was the fit that made the most sense, because not only does he just kind of know his role and have a good understanding and feel for the game, but he's also a forward that can defend on the perimeter and rotate down and protect the rim, which seems to be the key to NBA defense these days. You need to have at least two of those guys that can do that on the court at all times. And I definitely feel like his impact has really been felt, or his absence. You kind of feel the impact of that. But you also, it kind of reveals the fact that you're in a position where losing Dean Wade can really have an impact on your season. And that is a fragile place to be in, right? Like you don't want that to be the case. And I think Lamar has done a good job overall stepping up. But Lamar was someone that wasn't in the rotation to start the year. The right. competition for the small forward position was Caris LeVert, Isaac Okoro, and Dean Wade. And as much as the LeVert experiment didn't go great, that still was a net positive lineup, and it has been a net positive for them. Just looking at the cleaning the glass stats, it's plus 2.3. But I do feel like a lot of the issues kind of came on the offensive end, which was really not expected, because that lineup has a 104.9 defensive rating, which is fantastic, but a 107.2 offensive rating. And I kind of see now that Mitchell's back and the rotation's a little more normal, Caris LeVert seems to be finding his groove as that sixth man, and it seems to be a role that's really tailor-made for him. It's just trying to get that starting lineup to work with Lamar Stevens. And so far, with the exception of the Dallas game and one other game, that lineup has largely been a negative and has really hurt them at the start of games. And I don't think that necessarily has to do with Lamar. Maybe it has to do with just like the absence of continuity, because I'm looking at it now. Right now, Garland, Mitchell, Allen, and Mobley have only played 308 possessions together this season. That is really low. Like, that's as half as many as the Warriors starting lineup has played this season. Of course, cleaning the glass removes garbage time, so we have to add that disclaimer to that stat. But man, like, I just feel like sometimes it's hard to assess what the personnel issues are when you have just so little continuity throughout the course of regular season. Like, it's hard to, like, if these are the sample sizes we're dealing with, how can you even draw a conclusion from any of these lineups?
You can't. And I think it's probably tougher for teams that are trying to do, especially in this case, you're trying to do two main things, and that's develop like these younger players that are on your team that are not finished products, even the great ones like Darius Garland and Evan Mobley. And you're also integrating this huge new piece in Donovan Mitchell, and it's changed the complexion of your team. And so where a team like the Warriors, for instance, like, you can trust if Steph comes back from a shoulder injury in a few weeks, that starting lineup should still be great. They have such a long-standing relationship on the court with each other. And it was the same, like, oh, how are the Warriors going to integrate Clay when he comes back? Like, we just know it. Like, they've done it so many times before. The Cavs never have, like, really not gotten that feeling out process at full strength. And it's been, you know, it's in the regular season, it's always something. But to not even have, like, I don't know how many possessions like the Dean Wade starting lineup has played, but when you have your four best players only playing 308 possessions together, so it's going to be lower than 11. That, which means that it's,
The Dean Wade played 11. The Okoro has played 20. The Osman has played 26. I was mistaken. 308 is without Lamar Stevens. That's how many those four have played. And here's another like kind of small sample size theater thing. You look at the 308 possessions that the core four has played without Lamar Stevens. They have a plus 5.5 net rating in those minutes, and they are in the 97th percentile defensively. You add Lamar Stevens, who's a good defensive player, all of a sudden their defensive rating drops to 113.7 in the 45th percentile, and they're a negative 2.1 overall. Like, I just don't know if we can take anything away from this, but it's just interesting to me that this lineup change with Lamar going into the starting lineup, even though that lineup hasn't worked, overall, they have been winning more games. And I don't know what to do with this information at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be curious to see, like, what is the noise on opponent shooting then in the lineup that, you know, because Lamar Stevens is in there.
That's
and I'm looking, I guess opponents are shooting 40% from three when Lamar Stevens is part of that starting lineup. So like, that's a number where I don't think the Cavs are doing anything to just welcome 40 plus percent shooting from three. There's got to be luck caked in there. And so it's interesting because we are deeper into the season when you're dealing with stop and start issues like the Cavs are, and availability and just changes to some of what would be your core lineups. There are a few things that could just very easily skew the data. And then on top of having so many different iterations of information when you're looking at combinations of who's been available and what they've tried in those minutes, it sort of confounds it even more. And I think it makes it tougher to judge what they are at full strength. I will just say, even if it Dean Wade is mostly the answer, the point that you really hit on to me is just like, you don't want to be in a position where a Dean Wade injury is what derails so much of your season if you get to the playoffs, or, you know, even right before the playoffs. And that would be my primary concern there. But when you're a team this good, the word that we keep throwing around is information. I still feel like there's so much I don't necessarily know about the Cavs, despite having a good feel for thinking that, well, I know what this team does well. I know what they're able to do defensively for the most part. I know what their half court offense is capable of at even half tilt when things are going. But they have, and I think it's a pleasant unknown, even if it's a frustrating unknown, there's another gear for this team to get to, whether it's looking outward and finding improvement for the three spot, or just putting together a string of performances once Dean Wade comes back, where your best five man unit gets to be your best five man constant for like a month or something. Like, I know things prop up in the regular season, but this year, and other teams are dealing with a ton of injuries, but this is just, you know, we're talking about a lack of a sample size, with some of what should be, again, their most important units leading into the playoffs.
Yeah, I think that's probably the aspect that's most frustrating to me. Like, this season so far has 100% been a success. Like, if this continues for the next 50 games, we're laughing. Hosting a home playoff series exceeded all expectations, and I'm feeling really good about where they're at. But just from an analysis standpoint, it is difficult that there has been so little continuity, that there's been guys in and out of the lineup, and it really does make the analysis difficult. Like, even something like Jetty Osman, who blew a backdoor cut against Doug McDermott in the Spurs game and was promptly benched after that, and didn't play against the Mavericks, which I believe J.B. Bickerstaff, I was listening to Locked On Cavs. I didn't have the chance to see it all, but just mentioning, you know, he's got to earn the minutes and kind of understand the assignment. And obviously, we're not going to be privy to exactly what each player's expectations are and whatnot. But this has been kind of a recurring theme with Jetty, where he plays really well and then makes a couple decisions either on or off court, or we don't know, that seem to lead to him losing playing time. And for a team as top heavy as the Cavs, I feel like you can't really take a rotation player out of the rotation. But at the same time, it seemed like the message worked and they got a quality win against the Mavericks. So I have a tough time figuring out exactly what to make of the Jetty Osman situation, where you have a guy that is a helpful rotation player, but he's also a guy on a partially guaranteed contract for next year, which could be appealing in the trade market. And I almost feel like at some point you have to kind of make an assessment of, are we going to live with the ups and downs of this player, or do we have to make a decision? Because right now the Cavs, all they really have to offer as the trade season opens up is these expiring contracts. But the tricky thing for them is, all these expiring contracts are tied to useful rotation players that are part of their rotation. It's Kevin Love, it's Caris LeVert, it's Jetty Osman. All of those guys have contributed to winning. And I just, it really does make for kind of a difficult situation where I can't figure out exactly what the value is going to be, what the market's going to be, and if they're better off holding on to these guys and just hoping that more reps together makes it function better as a unit.
There's no distance too far for the perfect trip.
Hi, checking in for...
Or the perfect table.
Hey, where are you?
Coming!
And when you get access to Resi Priority Notify with your Amex Platinum card...
Hey, this looks amazing!
I'm so glad you made it.
And travel benefits at fine hotels and resorts booked through Amex Travel. It's worth the trip. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Yeah, that's a good point. I guess I will say, being in a position where it feels like you're trying to, even if, let's say, they know who their fifth best player is at this point, trying to constantly figure out your sixth or your seventh best player, where it feels like that's just on this ceaseless churn, that can be a real headache. And, you know, you mentioned like these players on expiring contracts are tied to useful players. The thing I've started to wonder is just, and it's in, again, it comes back to frustration because you're not going to know without Ricky Rubio there. But if he returns, does that just make Caris LeVert inherently less useful to this group, because there's already overlap when you look at what Caris LeVert does best. And now you throw someone in who's higher IQ just as a passer, but is also needs to be more ball dominant for the most part in Ricky Rubio. If you expect him to play important minutes, you threaten to either marginalize Caris LeVert's spot in the rotation, or you hurt his value to your team because he's still playing, but it's not under the optimal fit. Because right now, like him, you know, being someone who's in these bench heavier units, and yeah, you can sprinkle in some time when he's on with the four best players, it makes a ton of sense. But like when you're talking about him playing bench heavier units and Ricky Rubio is, you know, the other player on the court for that, like you really need to open up the floor, which is something that they've struggled to do as it is through availability or even just the talent that's on their roster. And so he's the guy that I've looked at because I think that he would probably have the most appeal to a team that's looking to get better without giving up the farm. And I do believe if you think Ricky Rubio can make an impact this season, even if you don't, you have Donovan Mitchell and Darius Garland. Like between staggering them and knowing that they're going to be on the court together during your highest stakes moments in the playoffs, does it just make him not, I guess not, it still makes him expendable, but yeah, would you rather trade a Jenny Osman than him? Sure. But just because he's going to actually have, I think, more appeal around the league, that's the player that I found myself constantly thinking about when it comes to if the Cavs are going to improve, or even if you want to say slightly shake up this roster, he feels like the starting point there.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where I think people, when they talk about the NBA, they become a little too transaction obsessed. Like I think like you go into an offensive funk, like I've seen people tweeting on Twitter, obviously, that the Raptors struggles, they should fire Nick Nurse because he's the reason that the offense doesn't work, blah, blah, blah. And to me, that's always seemed like a personnel issue, why they don't have a good half-court offense. But like it always gets blamed on either you put it on a coach or you trade a player. Like you let's cycle guys in and out rather than trying to look at what can actually be done internally. And Caris LeVert, as much as I don't like focusing on transactions, when you have expiring contracts and Caris LeVert, Kevin Love, Jetty Osman, like you have to make evaluations of, okay, do we feel comfortable riding this out for the season? Do we want to pursue an extension? Do we evaluate the trade market in? You're right. Like it does seem like Caris is getting more comfortable recently and has been playing a whole lot better. But some of that does seem tied to the fact that he gets to have the ball in his hands a little bit more in the second unit. And I think it's a valid question to say, is that going to continue when Ricky Rubio's there? But as far as a trade standpoint, like I don't love speculating on it, because if I would have told you that the Cavs could get Jared Allen for Dante Exum and the Bucks first, you would look at me like an insane person. Like it's so hard to tell what most trades that go through. If they would have been like tweeted out on Twitter, a screenshot of it beforehand, everyone would shoot it down as unrealistic. Right. But I do feel kind of confident saying that if they are going to make a trade this season, I can't really see it being with like a rebuilding team, because they don't have any first round picks to offer, which first seem to be devalued at this point in the NBA. And you really kind of have to find like a team that values getting a rotation player back while also prioritizing getting off of money. And there's not a lot of teams like that. The Clippers jump out to me as a team that has a ton of wings because they've hoarded every wing in the NBA. And a lot of them are long-term money, and maybe they value getting some ball handling back. But it's just not a straightforward thing. And I don't think it's as easy as saying, okay, go out and get a small forward that can play defense and hit three-pointers, because honestly, that has been a consistent struggle for this franchise outside of LeBron James for like the last couple decades. There's as like 3-and-D, because it's simplified to that phrase, sounds like something that's just out there and easy to find, but it really is a hard thing to find in the NBA.
To say the Cavs need functional shooting on the wing is like to apply a need that pretty much every single team in the league has.
Right.
And so that's what makes it difficult. And I think, you know, the other thing that I'm not sure that people fully adapted to is, you know, when I started covering the NBA like 10 plus years ago at this point, everything was really geared towards transactions. It was teams planning out years in advance for free agency. And so I think that's part of why the league is covered the way it is. But like free agency isn't what it once was. And now with the expansion of the play-in tournament, so many teams, they might have different end goals when you're talking about the postseason, but they fancy themselves playoff hopefuls, even if the definition isn't the same. Like if it was the Kings are better than this, but like if the Kings were in 10th, like they're going to be a team that's buying or actively not selling because they want to be in 10th and they want to make the play-in. And so you're talking about how, one, the Cavs aren't really built to do deals with sellers, and there are just fewer sellers at this point in the season than, I wouldn't say usual, but I think over the past few years, like, we've just seen there aren't as many sellers just in general. And then if you're trying to make a move with a buyer, teams are going to be like eminently more cautious with the moves that they make, because, one, do you want to help out another contender? And even if that doesn't factor into it, you want to be sure that it works, because you don't want to compromise your position at all. And so I think that makes it less likely that it's not just the Cavs, that other teams can solve some of their biggest issues through the trade market. I've also wondered if that's like why people attribute their so, I mean, we even had a question on our last Hardwood Knox mailbag, and it was from someone who didn't think that the Cavs should fire J.B. Bickerstaff, but like, there seems like a subset of Cavs fans that are unhappy with J.B. Bickerstaff. Like, he is somehow able to manage this team better. And I don't know, like, unless you have a problem with some of the, like, the non-starting units or the creativity there, I don't know how you assign, one, anything that's gone wrong to him specifically to the point where changing would do anything, or how you're so, like, why is third in the East bad? I know expectations come with a microscope, but like, you're third in the East. I don't care how small the gap is between you and the rest of the conference. Like, that's where you are. And we go back to last year. We go back 2 or 3 years. The Cavs would kill to be in a slump where they're playing 500 basketball. So
yeah, like, they're 6-4 over the last 10.
Right. So it's just, that's what boggles my mind, and why it's like, they don't seem like a team that will do anything to necessarily try and address it. Like, again, maybe it's on a smaller scale and all teams make moves. I will say, you mentioned the expiring contracts. That is where it gets interesting, especially when they're players who are going to have a market and maybe not get like bonkers paid, but like, a team will sign Kevin Love this summer and give him money. He's a very useful player. Caris LeVert will absolutely have suitors, and you've already committed money to Jared Allen and Darius Garland and Donovan Mitchell now. So you do have to have these conversations. They don't have to define your entire season. And I don't, you know, the other thing is what the Cavs need most, I just don't know if it's out there. Like, maybe they can go out and get a Luke Kennard from LA, but like, that might do some weird things to your defense. I know, like, you've been able to play with different lineups here and two small guards, but that's not going to necessarily help your defense. They might have
I'll
to
say
change.
This, that shooting, I'm willing to take some chances, man. They have a great defense with Caris LeVert at the three, right? Like, they've been able to make it work with a whole lot of things. I just want to see, I would love to see just a pure shooter with them. Whatever shape, size that comes in, like a not
Duncan Robinson,
like, that would be,
you want that contract?
Okay, not every shape and size. There's some shapes and size I'm less interested in. No, but you're right. And honestly, like, I do think, and this is getting a little sidetracked, but you were hitting on something that I've been thinking about lately, which is just, it does seem like there's been a shift in the way that people consume basketball in general, where sometimes they're more of a fan of a player than a team, and people like really kind of go out on these hills, and they live and die on their takes, and they care so much about it. And like, if a player they like is struggling, someone has to be responsible for that. Like, we have to blame the coach, we have to blame someone else, right? Like, they don't have the supporting cast, whatever the case may be, where sometimes it's just struggles. Like, for me, I was on an island with Darius Garland early in his career, right? Like, I've been one of the biggest kind of proponents of Garland over the last couple of years. And like, a lot of the struggles for the Cavs recently is just, hey, if Garland plays better, they win that game. Yeah. And these are the growing pains, right? Like, the growth isn't always linear. You're going to have hot and cold stretches throughout the course of a season. And when you try to add something to your game, sometimes that gets ugly. When you're trying to adjust to playing off of Evan Mobley as a playmaker or playing alongside Donovan Mitchell, sometimes there's going to be growing pains within that. And that's part of like growing and becoming a leader, is going out there and failing. I'm not insecure about the Cavs failing and having tough stretches, because we're finally at a point, and I just feel so fortunate as a Cavs fan to be at this point, where if this doesn't work out this year, we're still running back Garland, Mitchell, Mobley, and Allen. This is going to be it for the next couple of years. Like, it took Boston until last year to finally break through and get to the finals. But that first playoff run of that core was against the Cavs in 2018. Like, this stuff takes time. This is how the NBA used to be, where you would have kind of these trials and tribulations. You'd run into a wall. Giannis ran into a literal wall in Toronto in 2019 and eventually broke through. Like, this stuff takes time. You might be right in the long run and your takes might be well-founded, but just because over the course of a week, a player that you believe in or a team you believe in is struggling, that doesn't mean you have to go to these extremes and someone has to be held accountable. Like, you mentioned it at the top of the show, Dan, but like, the Cavs having a good half court offense with the limitations in functional spacing they have, with the injuries they've had, the lack of continuity they've had, to me, that points to good coaching. The offense overperformed. It was a top five offense for like the first 20 games of the season. And the fact that it's fallen down to 12th, like, to me, that feels more personnel-based and a result of some of the growing pains of a young team rather than J.B. Bickerstaff forgetting what made the offense successful at the start of the year. Like, to me, it feels like an execution and personnel thing more so than a coaching thing.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
And also, the other thing is just there's almost comfort in knowing when you're mentioning, oh, if Darius Garland just starts playing better, they're going to be infinitely better. When it's, I would have said Darius Garland was their best player leading into this season. I think Donovan Mitchell's been their best player this season. That's not really up for debate. But when it's, what was your best player just a few months ago is the one who's struggling. And it's also, oh, hey, who's the guy on this roster at the top that's needed to make the most adjustments or where this process has been the least organic for? Well, him. And it, you know, comes down to him missing the time with the injury too. Like, that robbed them of good reps together. But then also just like, he's the one that has to adapt functionally, I think, more than Mitchell has needed to. And I think even more so than Mobley. And the reactions are also, I would understand them from the perspective of, because we have started to see like windows in the NBA just shut. Ones that we thought were going to be open forever. I mean, we thought the Nets were inevitable, and look what I know they're near the top of the East now, but like, look what it became with James Harden after that, like how quickly that deteriorated. Look at how like the Warriors needed two gap years to prop this up. Even look at the Celtics. It was, you know, they went over so many different iterations. Like you said, they made the first playoff run in 2018. It's very rare that you keep the core together that long to see it go again. And Utah's situation was rare, where they had more cracks than it feels like a lot of other cores would have gotten before they made the wholesale shakeup. At the same time, this is not the NFL. We're not talking about scarcity of sample actually being a meaningful sample. There are 82 games over a course of a season. And when you are trying to read stuff into small samples, or where it's not like, oh, it's the top of the roster, that like the top of the roster is set. We're trying to figure out how to flesh out the 7 and 8 spots in their playoff rotation, like, and make them feel okay about that. But when you're working with such a small sample size over the course of such a large season, I think there deserves to be more runway there. It's okay. I think there are people who overstate when a take is hot, but there's just like this reaction to where it's like, no, every game in the NFL counts for like 8% of your season or whatever it is. Like, the NBA is just not like that. And we're getting to the halfway mark, but let's go back and actually look at, okay, you're rattling off the possessions that lineup has played with the four best players and how much time they spent with different threes. It's not a lot. Like, we're talking about tens of possessions, tens. That's nothing. That is nothing. And so that's where I think it's like important as a fan, as whatever media, it's not even me trying to like be demeaning to the fans who want to be reactionary. I get how sports fandom works, but it's also like, sometimes you have to take a step back when you're in this favorable of a position. This is not like the Cavs are in the play-in territory. This is not, oh, we have questions about any of the top four players on our rosters. This is what the Cavs are dealing with right now, both internally and externally for their fans, is a freaking luxury, like what's happening right now. Yeah. And so that's what I constantly come back to with them. But I do understand if you're concerned that this window might be transient because you've seen others shut and you know things come up. And you can almost sort of sense it, where I think Boston and Milwaukee are in a tier of their own as title contenders. And Milwaukee at this point, that's probably more born from trust than what I've actually seen this year. But they're in
a tier of their own. And honestly, they're probably the two best teams in the NBA, right? Like the Cavs would probably have a legitimate shot at the one seed if they were in the West this year.
And that is the thing, though, is after Milwaukee and Boston, it is so wide open that I could sense the urgency where it's, okay, this was kind of a long-term gambit with Mitchell, but the Cavs, if you told me the Cavs came out of the East right now, like I wouldn't, you know, I'd probably be like, well, that's not what I would predict, but it's totally a plausible outcome. So I get that expectation impacting how people view it, but we also have to, like, let's keep this in proper scale. There's still more than half the season to go. They haven't had a chance to look at some of the lineups that are going to be most important enough. And if you get to, you know, we're still, I know the unofficial start of trade season, which is really the start of nothing. It's just the start of trade rumors is all it is. That's all it is. We're still almost 2 months away from the deadline. And so if you don't have that sample by February 9th-ish, like that's when you go and you decide whether to make those changes. Or if you actually get more information in the next 7 or 8 weeks and it's not working, let's just see it and be like, if you're, I don't want to say be happy, but like just be comfortable knowing, oh, this team is still really good, even though it's imperfect.
Yeah.
Like that's not hard to, that's not a hard conclusion to draw. And it's also not, it's not the wrong one. It's not, I'm not here as a Cavs homer. Like, I didn't pick them to win the title. I think I had them fourth in the East. I might've had them for 50, to win 50 games, but like, I'm just watching this season unfold. And in a season that's been rife with uncertainty, when you look at availability from all these teams, I, like I told you before, I just have less of a feel for what's like trying to figure teams out than I can. The Cavs have probably been one of the more consistent watches that I've actually seen in the NBA. And so I think that's, there's probably real value in that when you look at the way the current landscape is unfurling.
Yeah. I mean, looking at it, the Cavs have the most double digit wins in the league. Like the fact that their road net rating is so good, they have this many double digit wins. Like, I think it really is kind of the shifting of expectations and also just a muscle memory thing. Like the last time the Cavs went from rebuilding to really good, there were big time expectations because it was a LeBron James window that, you know, is short. He's on a 1 year contract. It's, if you don't win the championship, it's a failure. Whereas this season, like, even if they were to like somehow bring in a really solid wing at the small forward position, I just, like, I have so much respect for the amount of experience you need. Just the fact that everyone is so young on this team. Like, I would not pick this team to win a championship. I would love for them to prove me wrong. Make me look stupid. Play this clip back at me. I'm going to have the most fun with it if I'm wrong. But what I really want to see from the supporting cast, and whether that's from internal improvements from guys like Dean Wade getting healthy, and Jetty Osman, Lamar Stevens, Isaac Okoro, and everyone else contributing and stepping up, I want the supplemental talent to at least provide enough help to that core four where if they come up short in the playoffs, it's because there's still growth necessary for Evan Mobley, Darius Garland, Jared Allen, Donovan Mitchell, where defenses aren't able to completely cheat off the small forward and do things defensively that you wouldn't be able to do against a normal roster. And it makes it harder to evaluate that playoff sample size. Like, you don't want it to be basically Steph Curry in 2019, where everybody went dead and they just go box and one to take him away. And it's so hard to evaluate anything, right? Like, you want the supporting cast to be good enough where it becomes, the onus is really on that core to work on their own games and to overcome the hump. Like, that's what I really want to see from this team. But before we get you out of here, I do want to ask you, as we're now at the kind of one third mark of the season, for the next, the second third of this season, what would you like to see from the Cavs that would help you get a better feel for them? Whether it's kind of a record-related goal or a development-related goal, like, what would you like to see as a next practical step for this second part of the regular season?
Ooh, that's a great question. I feel like I would like to see them get more experimental with Evan Mobley, and it's because I think they clearly don't have a margin for error if you want to be locked into that three seed. But because they're good and they're a playoff team, just what happens if you throw Evan Mobley out basically on an island in these lineups that are just bench heavy and like he is just the guy, like the actual focal point where it's, no, I guess you shouldn't be sitting, in theory, you shouldn't be sitting Mitchell and Garland together ever. Yeah. But I think there's so much value in trying to plumb the depths of what he can do offensively. And it's not like, hey, let's put the offense at a standstill to feed him. Like, let's actually let him process the offense even more, where he is the one who's operating from, like, the, you know, it, when you watch him play, he has like this zero step acceleration to where if you just give him the ball and he's like beyond the arc, like, he can make things happen immediately, whether he's putting the ball on the floor or not from there. And I think I would like to see even more of that. I recognize that that might actually be unrealistic because of the way that the Cavs are. And I've, like I said at the top of this podcast, I've actually been impressed with how much it feels like his offensive horizons have broadened, or at least remained intact relative to how they're made up. But I just, knowing how I think, how important I think he is to this team's future, even relative to what's already in place, I'd love to see them get wacky and weird with how he's used, and maybe even in some of the lineups he's used. And it's kind of like, you know, you've had enough availability issues where it's, is it really getting wacky and weird, or could some of it just be born out of necessity at this point?
You're not wrong. And I definitely think getting healthier and having the spacing around him to make that more possible would be really interesting, because I find that the rotations to be fascinating, because last year it was Evan Mobley's basically the backup center. And this year it kind of feels like Jared Allen is functioning more in that role, where they have Donovan Mitchell, Jared Allen, Caris LeVert, Jetty Osman, or whoever else kind of running that second unit. And I do like that from the standpoint of, if you feel so confident that Donovan Mitchell plus Jared Allen equals good offense and good defense for that second unit, like those lineups are killer. The bench lineups have been great for the Cavs all year. I do think it almost lends itself to that second squadron with Darius Garland and Evan Mobley. You can get creative with that two-man game, right? Like, have them play off of one another, let Mobley kind of be that second creator and really get some reps in there. And I definitely think getting someone like Dean Wade back would be really helpful. We'll see what happens with Jetty Osman, whether he gets more minutes in the rotation, because they've been really good in the Jetty minutes. It just seems to be a matter of him trying to not have those same kind of mental lapses on both ends of the court, that it really seems like the team is willing to live with some mistakes from guys. Like, it's okay if you miss your shots. It's okay if guys hit shots over you or whatever the case may be. But it's more about my assumption would be it's more about when you just completely kind of forget what your role is within the scheme. Like, obviously guys are going to have limitations and they're going to have defensive lapses, but it did seem like that breakdown where Doug McDermott got a very easy backdoor cut on Jetty was a bridge too far at that point.
To be fair, I feel like Doug McDermott might lead the NBA in easy backdoor. I don't know what it is about him where it feels like players just aren't in tune to that he's going to move. So I don't really know if that helps or hurts Jetty's case, but he feels like he might be in the majority rather than the minority with that specific player.
I mean, when I said I want a shooter in any shape or size, Doug McDermott definitely falls in that category.
I was going to ask you.
I was coveting some Spurs wings in that game for sure.
Yeah, the Jay Rich and just Doug McDermott. Like, those two were beyond perfect fits for this roster.
Richardson just absolutely killed them. That was a painful loss. Like, when I talk about, like, kind of managing frustrations and all that, trust me, listeners, I am frustrated as hell when that happens. Like, I'm really, like, I wear my heart on my sleeve when I watch games. That's why I have to watch games the second time, because the first time through is usually so emotional. It's just when it comes to the podcast and when it comes to tweeting it out, I try to take that emotional part of my my being and just go more kind of solutions-based. Let's get fair analysis. Let's talk about both sides of an argument rather than me just being an absolute lunatic watching a game.
I mean, I totally get, especially when it's the Spurs at this point in the season that they have had ever since they were off to that, like, rollicking 6-2 start. They have just been like, they might have already sent out, like, the Wembanyama jerseys at this point. Like, those might already be on site.
Yeah, but at the same time, man, like, it's crazy. I share how you feel about evaluating, because there's, like, no transitive property when it comes to looking at NBA scores right now. Like, you can't say, oh, well, they lost to this team by 7, but they're playing this team who struggled, so they'll probably win by 5. Like, it's all over the place. Like, Houston's got a bunch of good wins. Orlando just swept the Raptors over the weekend and then beat Atlanta. Like, it's so hard to evaluate the NBA right now. And I think part of that is just a product of, one, offenses being better across the board. So if you go in a slump, teams are going to make you pay for that slump. And I just think talent overall is so much higher than it's ever been in the NBA. And that makes it really hard to have an off night. And I think the Cavs are fortunate that they just kind of have that defensive personnel that they've been able to hang around in all these games and remain effective no matter where they are, even though there have been some road struggles.
Yeah, I mean, I'm totally with you there. It's that, the league being more talented, being deeper, and also just, I don't know if it's more reactionary when you're looking at the coaching level, but it does feel like teams are more inclined to make changes, whether it's to their starting units or the rotations, or there's just an influx of injuries and rest nights, and that makes it harder to trap because you can't look at a game and be like, okay, you lost to the Spurs, but like now you have to go and look. If you didn't watch, like, okay, well, how many players didn't, you know, appear in that game for whoever lost to them or whatever? Like the Warriors.
I definitely think coaching and front offices are a whole lot better than they used to be. Cause like when I was growing up, it was like, okay, like there's still like almost like the good old boy clubs where this guy's been around forever. He's made wild decisions, but you know, it's just part of the team's legacy or whatever the case may be. Like it feels like there's less and less of that. And when you're talking about the Cavs as trade season kind of comes upon us, like trying to find a partner, it almost feels like, in order to get it done right now, trades kind of have to be a win-win. Like it's almost like fantasy football in a redraft league where you are filling my needs and I'm filling your needs, and this is helping both out rather than wildly one-sided trades. Like that seems to be kind of more the status quo. Like even the Donovan Mitchell I think is a win-win where the Jazz were at a different stage of their team building process and the Cavs were able to consolidate and get a very special talent in Mitchell. Like I think, in order for the Cavs to pull something off at this trade deadline, it would need to be a similar thing where they are filling a need for another team and they're hopefully filling a need back.
Yeah, and I mean, the Jazz are a perfect example of why it's so tough to get a hold on what's happening in the NBA right now. Even though I think you look at their roster and it's like, oh, they were never going to be the worst team in the league, but you just assumed that they were going to make themselves. Like that Danny Ainge and Justin Zanuck were going to wheel and deal their way to the bottom, and now they're like just in the playoff hunt and it's too late to, there's talk about them being buyers and they're just heavily linked to John Collins all of a sudden. And so
I saw Indy might be a buyer, right? They were linked to John Collins in a recent report. Like sometimes I wonder if the NFL has real parity or if it's just small sample size. Cause like if you would have ended the NBA season after 16 or 18 games, like you're going to get some wild results. If you ended it now after 30 games, you're getting wild results. Like Indy is a 7 seed. Like New Orleans is the 1 seed. Golden State isn't even in the playoff picture. Minnesota's not in the playoff picture. Like Toronto Raptors are 10th. Atlanta's 9th. Like this is all over the place. It really, really goes to show you just like how tight the margins are in the NBA right now.
Yeah, and how the narratives are changing. Like, think about what was being said about some of these teams. Like, oh, everyone was touting Atlanta's defense to start the season, and now it's like, oh, do they need to trade Trae Young? He clearly a coach killer, has leadership problems. And so just, you're talking about, like, the results would be so weird if we ended it now, and yet people still react like we're about to end it now, I think. It's like what I said. There's not a scarcity of product in the NBA, and yet opinions are formed like it is. Like, it is the NFL where every single game counts for so much. And I know games mean more, I think, than people think when you're looking
at
it.
They really do.
The playoff field is 20 teams in a 30-team league now when you're factoring in the play-ins. Like, the games are inherently more valuable. But at the same time, it's like, we're dealing with an 82-game season here. This is not a 17-game season.
I think Carter actually has the right point where he says the playoff field is now actually 12, right? Because it's only the 6 seeds that are guaranteed a playoff berth. So it really does, like, the regular season matters again. And I think we went away from that when Kevin Durant went to the Warriors. Like I think that just broke everyone's brains. And I think that's part of when the conversation started to get to transaction, because it's like, well, it doesn't really matter what happens in the regular season. Like the Warriors just won 73 games and they lost the title. Now they got Kevin Durant and nothing matters, right? Like everyone got really nihilistic with it. It really, really matters. Like I'm looking at the Cavs now, after coming off that Dallas win, they have a really important home stretch here. Indiana, Dallas, Utah, Milwaukee, Toronto, Brooklyn, and then a quick road trip of Indiana, Chicago. Like there's a lot of Eastern Conference teams and all of that's going to matter to the standings. Like them, as much as we've talked about kind of the road struggles relative to the home, they're about to have a very, very, very important homestand, and how they do over this homestand is probably going to dictate where they end up in the standings, because January is a tough month from them, from a scheduling standpoint.
And that's also bizarre because of all the games you listed, there's not a single just gimme. Like maybe Chicago, depending on how you feel about that. There's like not just a single gimme opponent on that list.
Yep. This is going to be a real test for them. Like you probably have to do well. Like I love that the NBA is scheduling it where you play the same team twice in a short period of time. Like playing Dallas on Saturday, there's going to be adjustments. It's going to be really, really interesting to see how that goes. Both teams are going to be third game in four nights. Dallas is a little bit of a disadvantage there because they have to travel in to Cleveland the night after their game on Friday. So I'm curious to see how that goes. But Dan, I've taken up way too much of your time. I really, really appreciate this, buddy. I think it was much needed to kind of get an outside perspective on the Cavs. And before I let you go, do you have any parting thoughts, any wisdom for Cavs fans here?
Oh, no wisdom for me whatsoever, other than you guys are sitting in a really good position. And this team is exciting to watch as an impartial bystander. And I wouldn't sweat literally anything that we've seen just yet. Like if we get into February and we'll start talking about these road struggles or that they don't have the availability issues persist, then yeah, like we can approach it with emergency. But right now you're third in the friggin' Eastern Conference and you're in that second tier of title contenders. And I think that's a huge leap from last year. And you're set up more so than most teams for this window to remain open and to build upon it, even if this season is not going to play host to the ending that you necessarily want.
Well, if I can impart some wisdom to our listeners, it's subscribe to the Hardwood Knox podcast, because honestly, like I just don't have the time to watch other teams as much as I used to. And great national podcasts like yours are a big part of me actually staying somewhat in the loop. Although I will admit I'm in the dark. It is what it is. It's crazy times. There's so many games, so much real life stuff weighing on me these days, you know, but we get through it. And Dan, your podcast is absolutely one of my favorites. So big thanks to you. Big thanks to our listeners. We will be doing a mailbag episode on Sunday after the back-to-back, the home back-to-back against Indiana and Dallas. So very excited for that. We will be back on YouTube once Carter is back from his work trip. But everyone listening via podcast, you can support us by leaving a rating, leave a review, subscribe, unsubscribe, resubscribe, and help cook those books. If you want to be part of the Chasedown's exclusive Discord chat, send a screenshot of that review to chasedownpod@gmail.com. However you choose to support us, we really do appreciate it. Make sure you guys are staying safe out there. Until next time, go Cavs.